Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, probably two of the very few political people working today, but we're dedicated to you, our listeners, and we want to bring you our good, bad, and crazy martinis as usual. We start with the good, and Jim, we see in a new survey that the numbers are getting better and better from our perspective, worse and worse for Obamacare. Only 35% of people now like this thing, 62% disapprove, 54% of women had disapproved. Now that's up to 60. And if Obama has lost the women on this, it's only a matter of time, hopefully, before this thing crumbles. And he may be sitting over there in Hawaii trying to figure out why. And I think, actually, yesterday on CNN State of the Union with Candy Crowley, one of his own fellow Democrats, Joe Manchin, explained pretty well why people hate this.
If it's so much more expensive than what we anticipated, and if the coverage is not as good as what we've had, you've got a complete meltdown at that time. So this transitional year gives you a chance to adjust the products to the market and to see if the market will absorb and buy the product. You can't tell someone, give me all your vitals, then I'll let you shop a couple of things.
In other words, they have to go on and say, here's all this information about me.
Yeah.
And then you have to buy.
Well, are they willing to basically come to the realization, this is all America's willing to pay, and this is what they're wanting for what they pay, and are they getting the best product? Don't say, this is what you've got to buy, whether you like it or not, and you're going to pay more, even though you didn't think you were. I think that's where we are.
Now, Jim, we know that sometimes Joe Manchin's votes don't match the rhetoric, but he gets it.
You're seeing Obama in his press conference on Friday. This weekend, Howard Dean was making the same point. There's an article of faith amongst some diehard Obamacare supporters that the issue is just the website, and they're fixing the website, and so it's going to be hunky-dory. And the answer is no, that there's a whole bunch of variables. They're basically things that have to go right for Obamacare to work. One, obviously, is that people have to go visit the website, and they have to buy their insurance through the website, which means also, like, they have to understand that in addition to selecting the plan, you have to pay for it. And that's why they keep kicking these deadlines further back, because people don't. But then the other question is, you know, once they get on there and they see those plans, do they like them? Are the prices better? The whole thing is called the Affordable Care Act. The number one reason people didn't buy health insurance was they thought it was too expensive. Well, if they go online and they find everything's more expensive than even what they thought was too expensive before, then you're going to be, you know, banging their head against the wall saying, why did we pass this thing? It's only making the problem get worse and worse. At some point, we have to begin our coverage process. Today is the deadline if you want to have insurance starting January 1st. And at that point, we have 50 state, you know, markets. The question is, do they have enough young people? There are lots of people who are happy to point to states where there are a decent number of young people signing up. New York and California are looking okay. But there are, you know, 48 other states. And in any one of them, if you have only old sick people signing up and not enough young, healthy people signing up, those exchanges will not succeed. And you will see the death spiral accelerating. So a lot of ways this can go wrong. One of the things that's kind of been the, you know, the theme of the discussion from the beginning was, well, whenever someone like you or I say all the things that can go wrong, you know, for the Obamacare defenders, Pajama Boy, and folks like that will say, well, that's the worst case scenario. We're 3 months in. Isn't it time to start contemplating the worst case scenario? Is it really that unthinkable in light of everything that's happened so far? Yes, worst case scenarios are rare, but they happen. And so far, there have been enough things that have gone wrong that it's not this unthinkable, far-fetched scenario. And yet the administration keeps insisting time and again, there is no backup plan, that we are stuck with this, which means there's going to be a whole bunch of people going to be very, very unhappy in the new year when they find out that either they think they signed up for a plan and they hadn't, they signed up for a plan and they signed up for the one that has good premiums, and then they find out, oh, by the way, there's a huge deductible. There's, you know, people are going to find themselves, you know, the hospitals are now worrying about the possibility of people getting bills and then not paying them, you know, starting next year. You got to wonder how many folks are just going to erroneously assume that now that they're under Obamacare, somebody else pays for it. You know, it's, as I said, described it last week, a Dagwood sandwich of bad news from top to bottom. And it's good that people are, you know, turning against this law, because now it's not theoretical. It's not, you know, some far-fetched scenario from crazy right-wingers like you and me. People are living it and they're seeing it's every bit as bad as we warned it was going
to
be.
All right, on to martini number two now, and it turns out that Edward Snowden has some more information that's creating headaches for everyone. And according to his latest bit of NSA material, it looks like the U.S. and the U.K. actively spied on Israel, tapping communications at the highest levels, and did the same with foreign NGOs and commercial enterprises as well. This comes from Ed Morrissey at hotair.com. And so, Jim, what the Israelis want to do in return now is demand even more fiercely the return of Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard. Most conservatives, I know you certainly do, believe that while what Snowden may have revealed makes people uneasy, this is not necessarily the right way to go.
Pollard has been this sticking point in U.S.-Israeli relations for a really long time. There are good folks on the right who I respect a great deal, who think of themselves as being very pro-Israel, who believe that what Jonathan Pollard did was not that bad. What Jonathan Pollard did was pass classified information along to Israel. Israel was and is our ally at the time of his actions, but nonetheless, he's a spy. You know, it doesn't matter whether the country you're passing it to is bad guys or good guys. You know, when you sign an oath and saying I'm going to protect classified information, you do it. You know, some people see his sentence as being really harsh, but I basically believe that passing classified information to a foreign government, even a nice foreign government, even a one we like, is not okay. And that you have to, you know, throw the book at people in circumstances like this. And the idea that, well, it's not that bad because it's a country we like. Look, the sharing of information with our allies is a decision to be made at the highest level. You can't have everybody with access to classified information deciding what to declassify or what to share with foreign governments, because then you end up with a government full of Mannings, right? I mean, we have these rules for a reason. You can argue if you want to say, you know, Bradley Manning or Snowden are being punished too lightly. That's fine. You know, you can make that argument, but I don't think Pollard is a good reason for this. It is embarrassing for us to be in a situation in which foreign leaders know that we are spying on them. But how many different governments do you think are trying to intercept Obama's communications? I'm sure if we asked, say, Israel, have you ever tried to catch intercept the communications of U.S. presidents? I'm sure many of them would say, oh, no, we never did that. But I think there's a very good chance that at some point in their history, they probably have. And even if they haven't, every government does everything it can to get as much information as possible. Good governments do this and bad governments do this. And I don't think necessarily if you become leader of an entire country, you can demand a right to privacy to all your communications. But I think ultimately in a world of spy versus spy and all kinds of technological advances in intercepting communications, if you really don't want it to be spied upon, write a letter.
This comes at such an unfortunate time because relations between our two countries were so good the last couple of years.
Yeah, going hunky-dory, yeah. I mean, you know, Angela Merkel, she was the one who seems to have, like, set this off and been most offended, and the Brazilians are. And I can't help but think a lot of this is a bit of play-acting for their domestic audiences. You know, this is a chance to look like you're standing up to the big, bad Americans. Because really what it is you might say it's a cynical viewpoint, but look, you know, this is the way the world works. Governments spy on each other, even governments that like each other. I mean, we want to know exactly what the Brits are thinking before we go into a meeting with them. And there's a bit of dialogue from Heat that I like to quote in situations like this. It's assume they have our phones, assume they have our homes, assume they have, you know, every possible way of communicating. Assume that it's bugged and spied and assume that they're watching it and only use, you know, methods of communication where you know it's absolutely secure. And that often means face-to-face in a room that you've had swept for bugs and circumstances like that. Just the way it is. That's a reality of the world. And the idea of, you know, we're going to release Pollard as some sort of apology to the Israelis is kind of disturbing and just shows just how bad the Snowden revelations have turned into. I think it also says something about the dangers of running as a hope and change avatar who's going to be playing kumbaya with all these countries, because obviously Obama did not change that and in fact probably expanded that. People are justifiably cynical. Merkel and the Germans and all kinds of, you know, the European left is one who has most reason to be furious about this because Obama's turning out to be the opposite of what he said he was going to be. Some of us aren't that surprised. Some of us have been warning about expiration dates for a long time. But, you know, welcome to the real world, folks.
All right. On to the third and final martini for today, the crazy martini. As you know, the president is off in Hawaii, and I'm sure most of his day will be spent with recreation, maybe a briefing or two here and there. But he's also doing something very important because, according to Valerie Jarrett, the president later today is going to be signing up for Obamacare because, as Jim pointed out earlier, it's the last day he can do it if you want to be covered by January 1st. But as Jim points out in the campaign spot today, he doesn't actually need it. So, Jim, what's going on here?
When the president gets health care, who pays for it? And the short answer is that in almost all these circumstances, you do as the taxpayer. This is not something that was set up just for President Obama. It's just always been standard, you know, going back for as long as there have been doctors and presidents. The president's health, which obviously is pretty important, particularly in an era of attempted assassinations and efforts to take out the top person in our government. the president has the best medical care available in the entire world, and he should get it. Usually he gets it from places like Walter Reed Medical Center or other military hospitals, but there's also a medical unit right there in the White House. So if at some point, you know, President Obama was having chest pains in the Oval Office, one of the four doctors there, plus nurses and physicians, would be able to run in and take care of him immediately. Same thing on Air Force One. They have two medical teams that travel with him when he travels abroad in case one happens to one of the teams. They have another one. All this extends to the president's family. All this also applies to the vice president. All this applies to the vice president's family as well. The president does have an insurance plan. He is given the same choice of about 10 different plans that federal employees get. But as I noted, almost all this is provided by the U.S. taxpayer. In my research, I have yet to determine what, if anything, he pays for. And my understanding is not much, if anything at all. Now, once he leaves office, it may change. He gets a certain amount, and he is entitled to use the entire military hospitals and everything he's been used to so far. At that point, I guess it's the same kind of care that is available to veterans. The president gets this by being commander-in-chief. It doesn't matter if he is a veteran or not. He's signing up for insurance. He's not buying insurance. I'm wondering if he actually will be actually purchasing or whether it's just going to be, you know, he'll be one of those folks who's signed up but never actually sent the check. But in his case, he could say, look, he doesn't really need to send the check because his medical care is taken care of. Now, some people will find this irritated that this entire law has been implemented by somebody who's never going to have to worry about quality of care for the rest of his life, nor will any of his children have to, nor will his wife, nor will, you know, probably any of his, you know, if someday he has grandkids, they'll probably all be well taken care of. All of this is largely theoretical to him, and which is why he says, well, one of the things we've learned is that purchasing insurance is complicated. Well, I guess now President Obama will get a chance to experience it himself. And perhaps he's going to bring a laptop with him as he sits out on the beach out there in Hawaii somewhere.
So, Jim, I guess the only question now is, as he tries to sign up, will he get the hourglass of death, the pinwheel of death, or the blue screen of death, perhaps?
I think we can safely say that if it goes down for maintenance today, it is not scheduled maintenance on deadline day. He says he's trying to lead by example. If he goes on and he finds this site absolutely impossible to navigate and a pain in the neck and everything's confusing and nothing's clear, well, in a way, that's good. That shows him what everybody else in America has been going through. I might have had the president doing this, say, on day one or day two, so he could see exactly what it was. He says no one's madder than he is about this, but he never seems to behave that way. Otherwise, you think, you know, I mean, Kathleen Sebelius still has her job and lots of other folks still have their jobs. But we'll see if he has any thoughts on it after this experience. My guess is it'll be a photo op. And like I said, this is a decision that doesn't actually affect his health care until after he leaves office at the earliest. And even then, he's going to be in a circumstance where he'll be able to avoid, you know, to purchase the, you know, most super duper terrific platinum plan ever. And that's just kind of something we've agreed to in this country. And I think most presidents are entitled to because of all the other things they deal with in the job. But it does make people feel like he's not practicing what he's preaching, and that he's just out of touch with the problems of the average American trying to get health insurance. So we'll see how it goes, and we'll see if the site crashes on him. It'll be, you know, I think some people will chuckle a bit at the karma, won't they, Greg?
Well, today is the final daily version of the Three Martini Lunch podcast for 2013. But fear not, starting tomorrow, we start our special series of year-end political awards that will run for several days, and then we'll be back in a couple of weeks with our daily edition. Jim, a very Merry Christmas, and we'll talk to you soon.
See you next year, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Have a very Merry Christmas, and tune in tomorrow for the first of our special editions of the Three Martini Lunch.